This morning, just a little background. The expectations for the Farnborough 2016 were limited. Brexit had just passed, and despite dire predictions, the UK would not flow away into the Atlantic. New orders were expected to be as robust as prior years, and key areas of discussion are expected to include the shortage of pilots, data requirements for airframes, and aircraft tracking. How many people here did attend the Farnborough air show? Okay. All right. Nobody else did. Okay. Okay. There we go. Some of the things that are going to be discussed this morning will be, we're going to address the questions, why go to the largest air show in the world? What can one get out of the air show that helps your organization? And is the cost of attending worth the expense? Our panelists include David Conrad of Zodiac Aerospace, and is moderated by David Patterson, CEO of Aerospace Manufacturing and Engineering. David, you want to go ahead and introduce?
Well, it's hard to top David Conrad's already trying to think of a good word to use to reference his eloquent description of himself, but as he indicated, he's got over 30 years of experience in the aerospace and defense industry, in a cross-section for sales, marketing, business development, strategic planning, supply chain development, repair capabilities, customer support, and process improvement. This gives him a great perspective to offer with regard to this year's show. And with that, let's just jump right in. David, I mean, normally I'd have to introduce three or four people. Everybody dropped out at the last minute because they had to rush out of town, and or I secretly believe that since they found out David was going to be here, and his notorious description of his industry, his sector within the industry, they were concerned about being identified with.
Does everybody understand what the Farnborough Air Show is? Is that good, everybody? Okay.
The Farnborough, along with Paris Air Show, is the longest running air show in the world and the largest, most attended. Although these days, the guys in Dubai are starting to catch up, and a few other spots.
Yeah, the Middle East is kind of establishing their own place in the air show industry. It's just there is a bit of a bifurcation between Paris and Farnborough, because Paris is much more commercial. Mm-hmm. Farnborough has more of a defense type slant. Even though there's commercial activity, there is a little bit more of a defense slant to the Farnborough show. So it's a little bit, they have very different characters between the two. And there are, you know, every alternating years, even years or Farnborough odd years or Paris. But, you know, I heard the question posed about the value of going. I mean, for me, I've been going to air shows, regardless of whether it's Farnborough or Paris or Singapore or Middle East or all of those, for many, many years. And the value for us is that if you plan yourself well, which means you book meetings, you've got something to do, it is a chance to get a time with your key customers all in one location, all at one time. It takes a lot of work to do that, which is why if you do an air show, you work your backside off.
Question Paul, do you see the major purpose of the show then to connect with customers you already have, or do you look, to what extent do you look for generating new customers, although that may be unusual for your particular application, since I suspect you already have customers around the globe?
It's actually both, Ivan. Because even though we are we have been, you know, we have established customers, you know, the big OEM.
Yeah, about 80% of the market, aren't you?
Yeah, about 80% of the market. But it did, you know, like at this show, we were able to sit down and have discussions with new customers, new opportunities. So it's a mix of both for us, at least that's my experience.
How far in advance do you begin planning your meetings?
Usually about 60 days out, we start trying to set it up. We define who we want to talk to, what we want to talk about. And then, particularly when you're dealing with, you know, for me, the air show is a great opportunity to see those customers where it's really difficult to get to them. For example, if I'm visiting with Antonov in the Ukraine, boy, it's a pill to go to Kiev. It is challenging. Or I want to talk to Ilyushin or Tupolev. It's very hard to get to them there. But they all come to the air show. So it gives me a chance to kind of get those. And those are the ones you start with first. And then some of the other ones you kind of...
Your primary customers are the OEMs, the airframe OEMs.
For the most part, yes.
So you have a bifurcated customer, but you also have to deal with the airlines?
Well, we don't so much deal with the airlines. The other, we have a, within Zodiac, we have a service organization that handles the airlines. The folks that we deal with beside the OEMs are what I call the mod centers.
Gotcha.
The people who are changing the airplane.
Interiors.
The interiors or the airplane itself. And we talk to them as well. So those are really the customer groups that I deal with the most.
So these are the guys that are, for the sheiks, buying the 380s and converting them into penthouses and all
that. It could be that group, or it could be, I've got some folks who are refurbishing existing aircraft. Or, you know, it's been in cargo service, they want to upgrade and refresh it. Or I've got military people who maintain these, what we call the mission-type aircraft, and they want to upgrade it. So it's that broad, it's a broad sector. But those are the kind of guys that we've been talking to.
How do you know who's going to be there, and therefore who to make appointments with?
Well, fortunately, the organizing committee of Farnborough and Paris are kind and gracious enough to put the list of exhibitors on their website. So you start there. But in cases of doubt, I mean, I had a couple of folks we reached out to this year and said, you know, hey, you're going to be there. We want to talk. Some were, some weren't. It just kind of varied wildly. But, you know, you generally can start with who's on the exhibitor list from the website.
And how long are the meetings generally?
Depends on the content, depends on the subject, but generally about an hour to an hour and a half. Just somewhere in that range.
One of the things we did a number of years ago, we did a breakfast for people that were thinking of going to Douglas Farnborough. And one of the attendees at the breakfast, we'd never been to Farnborough. Because we asked him what their expectations were. And his comment was he expected to come back with X million dollars worth of POs. And yeah, I was going to follow up on that. The feedback was, you're not going to come back with any, because the people that you meet with don't issue POs. They can introduce you to people that issue POs.
Rarely.
But then, is that accurate? So that's, I guess I'm following up to make sure that's still true.
For me, the purpose is, I'm not coming back. I would probably fall over and pass out if I ended up with a purchase order at the show. But that's not to say that if I haven't pre-greased the skid for a contract signing or something like that, that does happen. All right. But for the general, generally, the purpose for us is to continue to build relationships or establish new relationships at the show. Because generally, the companies, they don't send they send their senior people.
They will.
Companies send their senior people.
Oh, okay, great.
And so it's a chance to get that senior level relationship established and built or reinforced, your choice.
Would you say that's the major purpose of the show as far as or benefit, or however you want to say it.
Right. I think the major purpose is reinforcing or establishing the senior level relationships of the companies that you want to do business with. It's like, I can tell you, Boeing and Airbus and the big guys, they all run around 3 to 4 months before the show, and they're going, okay, we're going to have a contract signing at the show, and, but for the most part, that's another world.
It's all staged.
David, are you also an exhibitor, or do you just go and attend and work the show and have these meetings?
We exhibit.
Okay.
Zodiac, the corporate exhibit. So we have a corporate booth this year. Well-placed, I may say. Mother Nature had her say on the show this year. For those who weren't aware, that we had a washout on Monday. It rained like crazy and flooded tents, and because they run the electrical wires under the carpet, they basically closed everything for safety reasons and threw everybody out at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Monday.
I guess part of it's tiered, so it...
Yes, well, it's, the hall one is at the bottom, 2, 3, and then 4. Our exhibit was in 4. We were great. We were at the top of the hill. Everything was closed.
That's typical of your business.
but it was... and we actually have one of the... Some companies opt to do what they call outdoor exhibits. And Lockheed Martin was one, and the rain collapsed the roof of the exhibit.
Wow.
Nobody was hurt, but it was just, it was a real mess trying to get out of there. When the fastest route back to central London was to take the bus. That kind of speaks the craziness.
Going into Farnborough, what were your expectations? Did you have a lot of high expectations, or are you just almost in a maintenance mode?
Well, when we go to the show, because it is, as you said, it's a significant investment, we sit down and we say, what do we want to accomplish, that 60 day, 90 days ahead of time? What are we trying to do? And that really determines the set of tone for what we do there and the people we bring, the things that we do. And so it varies from show to show. We had some specific objectives this time in terms of working with about 3 or 4 core customers that we need to do some things with. There's the big guys like the Boeings and the Airbuses, we see those people almost monthly. We're not seeing them at the show. I'll run into people we know and we'll have a conversation. But we're targeting more of that second tier, the smaller OEMs. And that's what we did this year. We had some very specific objectives with the smaller OEMs.
Now, because you're part of Zodiac, do you coordinate with Zodiac Corporate, or are you left to your own devices and own imagination?
From a booth perspective, we coordinate with Zodiac Corporate because we're going to share the booth, and in some cases, we'll host meetings at our booth. But as far as meetings with customers are concerned, that's our responsibility. We have to do it. And so we go do it.
Okay.
The big question going into Farnborough was, let me see if I can phrase this right. How real is the 8 to 9 year backlog? Are we going to get lots of cancellations, or what's going to happen? Is there going to be the typical announcement of 1,500 sold, or is it going to be 1,500 cancellations, or what? As an indicator of what the future is like, what's your read? What did happen, and what's your read on that?
I'm glad you asked that question. I actually wrote notes on that subject.
If you can find them.
They're right here in front of me. I got you. Let me kind of take it from an overall perspective to go down. When I look at the show itself, the number of exhibitors, the number of trade visitors was a little bit higher than in 14. A little bit. About 1,500 exhibitors and about 73,000 trade visitors. But, as you rightly pointed out, there was a large, huge would be a better word, drop in announced orders. because if you look at the show this year, only about 50 billion in orders were announced. Take that back to 2014, it was 200 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So about 25% of what was done a few years ago. When you look at where the orders were coming from, it starts to reflect some of the changing dynamics in the marketplace. Asian carriers were the biggest buyers. Middle East, Europe, Americas, relatively quiet. You know, some smaller orders, relatively quiet. The other part of that is leasing companies, which have been the bulwark of order books for a while, were very quiet. Less than 20% of the orders and options went to leasing companies. Compare that to last year at Paris, 31%, and in 2014, Farnborough, over 50% of the orders went to leasing companies. So you're seeing some shifting dynamics about the marketplace.
The purchasers, the airlines?
The airlines, correct. A lot of discussion, you know, because Farnborough, the annual Farnborough Paris, or when Boeing and Airbus tend to release their market forecast and shoot it out and argue it out. There is a divergence there between what Airbus is seeing in the marketplace and what Boeing is seeing in the marketplace. Not so much in the narrow body and the smaller wide body, but at the high end, the very large aircraft. Clearly, Airbus is seeing more opportunity there. Boeing is not.
We're talking about the 380-747?
380-747 class. In fact, there was a lot of discussion about have we seen the last of the 747s that took place around the show. Because
they pretty much said they're going to stop production for a while. They make the skins out right out here in Oakland or whatever it is, and that basically is
getting shut down.
Yeah, Marty Jones used to be head of that, and that's pretty much gone by the wayside.
What we did see is a lot of the commercial segment.
So Airbus sees the possibility of the 380s, and Boeing figures that the days of the jumbo, the 747, are over.
That's really the read, is that Boeing is seeing that the what they call the smaller wide body market, 787, 350. Is where they believe the future is going to be. Part of that is the philosophical approach about hub and spoke, or about point to point versus large consolidated hub and spoke. It's a philosophical difference that's been very evident between the two of them for quite some time.
So the Airbus ain't selling the 380s, except the Emirates, and they've cut down production to one a month or something like that.
They will not cut production to one a month until January of 2018. They're going to continue with the current run rate until that, and then they'll come back. That's the plan. I can only report the plan.
So questions about that model, the future of that model, are still undetermined.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
It should also be noted that Boeing made a very definitive engineering and strategic change in the 90s when they pushed to the 777 with a twin engine model away from a four engine model, which drove the engine companies to produce engines with higher thrusts, greater fuel efficiency, and so on and so forth. And that's a lot of another structural element to this whole thing.
There is, and there's a lot of jockeying taking place between Boeing and Airbus these days, because number one, you look at their you just look at their business, their cash cow is the narrow body. All of a sudden, they have people jumping into that segment. We have the C-Series. We have the MS-21 or MC-21, depending on which Cyrillic alphabet you're using. And then we have the C-919. So that cash cow is kind of coming under pressure. How Boeing and Airbus respond to that will be a very interesting thing to watch. I think part of this is when you look at the backlog that both of these guys have, they're both talking about moving to a 60 a month production rate. Can they do that? Will the supply chain sustain it? they're already kind of having issues today.
I think they put that in context, it's like 42 right now, right?
44 to 48. Yeah.
So you're talking about increasing it by 50%, both of them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of suppliers supply both. So, you know, that could be a supplier could be faced with a 100% increase in demand.
Yeah, yeah. It's a real challenge for both of them. Can they get to that rate and sustain that rate? Because right now the problem is that Airbus for sure, but Boeing to a lesser extent, they sell slots. And when the slots are full for a year, we're done. Move to the next. It just keeps rolling. That's how you build the backlog. There's a very active secondary market in selling slots these days.
Get out of town.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Airline wants it earlier. They go look for somebody who's got an earlier slot, and they'll pay them a little money for it. It's a very strange phenomenon.
Cannibalizing slots. I'll be damned.
Another major question that got a lot of debate was, you know, the Boeing has come out with their 777X. Which kind of tops the A350 current configurations that are out there. Will Airbus decide to come out with a larger A350, what they call the A350-1000? Good question. If you look at the market, Boeing is getting their backside waxed by Airbus on the high end of the narrow body. The 737 MAX 9 mm-hmm. and the A321. 321 is outselling at almost 3-1. They're killing them. So now the challenge is, will Boeing respond with what they call the middle of the market design, a 757 type replacement, and it's a single hour twin on.
Is that the redesign they're talking about?
It's a debate. The debate that's been going on, or bits that have been heard, is do we stretch the MAX 9 out and make it a MAX 10, or do we take a 757 and redesign? It's not determined. If you listen to the Boeing people there, they say it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. But in the meantime, Airbus is just having their way with it.
And what's the reason for that? What are the prime characteristics of causing that out so point?
When you look at the performance on, you know, and you always get the wonderful arguments back and forth between Boeing and Airbus, but the argument that seems to be sticking right now is the Airbus argument that the cost per seat mile, the operational cost per seat mile of the 321 is significantly out of the MAX 9.
Financial.
It's all financial driven.
Do you not feel that there's any part of it that's culturally driven? Or is it all?
Can I avoid that question?
Next question.
I think it's I think Airbus has been much more aggressive to the market and has been much more attuned to the changing dynamics of the market than perhaps Boeing has been with this. You know, both of them have excellent and outstanding sales teams that go out there, but Airbus is making hay. I mean, because when you look at what Boeing has sold for the MAX today, they've got a backlog of 3,000. Hang on one second, and I'll tell you. The Boeing backlog is only for MAX is only about 3,200. The 3,200 aircraft for MAX. Airbus has almost 4,700 of their NEOs sold. So they've done a much better job of getting out there. And the market is reflecting that. And I think that has, despite the calm demeanor, I think that has Seattle concern.
What's your read on the, to go back to the fundamental question, what's your read? A year ago, everybody was dancing in the streets, you know, we got an 8 to 9 year backlog. The world is hunky-dory. We're in great shape. And like at Speed News, everybody on the panel, they all were positive. Speed News this year, half of them were negative, half of them were positive. Half of them were saying, we hit the peak, it's downhill from here. And Farnborough was supposed to be an indicator of which of those two projections are correct. That you have the one being the 8 to 9 year backlog is here to stay. The other one being we've hit a peak and it's going to be through your normal 8 year cycle. Which do you read from what you saw at Farnborough?
What I saw at Farnborough was we're not going to add a whole lot more to the order books right at the moment. That we will continue to produce at some rate and increase, you know, kind of there will be continued ramping until probably 2020. And then starting at 2020, you'll see some tapering. Not a lot, but some tapering of the rate for probably 3-4 years. And then it'll pick up again. That time frame burns off most of the current backlog.
Really? So we expect the 8 to 9 years, right?
We expect, I would expect that from what we're hearing, we would expect the backlog to shrink as they produce. They're going to produce at insane rate.
Especially if the production goes from the 42 up to 60 and stay the same.
Yeah, but the reality is that it's 60 units. It won't be a lot of production.
This is just right now what the forecast we've been hearing was you're going to go from about 1,420, I'm just talking Boeing, the duopoly, 1,420 this year to 1,878 by 2020. A year.
25% increase.
It's going to burn out a lot of the backlog.
Run through backlog.
Will you lose backlog? Yes, you will. Everybody knows that. You will lose backlog.
Because the sales will...
It's just, well, the economic situation or an airline situation is going to be a part of it.
Yeah, but backlog today is way overstated comparative to historical perspectives. It's huge.
Well, I guess it goes back to whether you believe the traffic models are accurate or not as to whether it's overstated.
Well, but their orders are they are current orders, but they can be canceled.
Theoretically, any order can be canceled. But what I was saying is, when I look at the backlog dating going back 30 years, this backlog is by far the largest backlog that the industry has ever seen.
Yeah, but I don't think you can really measure that. I don't think that's an appropriate measure because the economic conditions, the economic dynamics are not the same as they were 30 years ago.
Don't disagree at all.
I think that what we see is it boils down to, do you believe the traffic growth is there? If the traffic growth is there, you need fixed overtures for people.
Well, in that light, there's a, for those of you who are members, you know, there's a what's new section of Jeremiah, under resources, and one of the articles there, Deloitte, which is specifically on this topic, you know, what's the reality of the backlog? And the summary of that is that they think that it will actually stay that way. His analysis of the sales is that, let me get this right, that it's equivalent to the replacement plus the increase in traffic. Mm-hmm. So his prediction is that the 8 to 9 years is going to stay. That we're out of the 8 year cycle that
right.
we were. And that, no, he doesn't talk about the kind of stuff you just said, but that would be the gist of the article, is that the 8 to 9 years, in his opinion, from Deloitte, I think it was Tom Captain who wrote it, I'm not sure. But you have to check, it'd be worth reading that article and form your own opinion.
Yeah, so, you know, you're always going to have some cancellation, just stuff happens.
Yeah.
You know, when I talk to the folks at Boeing, when I talk to the folks at Airbus and Embraer and Bombardier and do these market studies and the forecast guys, they're not seeing a lot of, it's not going to be wholesale cancellation. It's not going to be just drop off. it's there.
But interesting, some interesting speed news conference in March.
It'll be a very interesting speed news conference in March. The thing that I did find enormously interesting, though, out of Farnborough is, there's the new stuff, got it, was the emphasis on the regionals, and there's a lot of activity in the regional market. And even more stunning is the emphasis on the aftermarket. Because most of the bigger deals that were thrown out were related to the aftermarket side. Whether it was a power by the hour kind of a thing, or some sort of a maintenance contract. So a lot of activity in that area. Satair, which you may know or may not know, is actually kind of the aftermarket arm of Airbus, like ABL is below it. Satair is reporting double-digit growth in the aftermarket. And when you go to some of the other big players, they're not far behind. High singles. That's amazing. That's an amazing.
When you're referring to aftermarket, are you talking about MRO particularly, or are you talking about aftermarket product sales, or what?
All of the above. All of it. Aftermarket is everything after the plane arrives at the airline.
Okay.
So it's spares, repairs, the whole product. The whole
do upgrades and all that fall into it too, avionics?
Upgrades, modifications, all falls into that, yes. Yep.
So the interesting thing is how this whole buying of slots is going to play into this whole E-9 thing. It's going to cause the people that were going to go in now just to delay it a little bit and still keep their spot or whatever. It's be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, it does allow, the secondary market and slot selling does allow, and that may be one of the relief mechanisms on this whole idea of are you going to get cancellations? Hey, I've got a slot for next year, but I don't want it now. I'm going to delay it. I'm going to tell somebody who wants a plane now. So that, I think, it's almost like a pressure relief valve to the market, allowing some of the pressure to come off of the airlines that have orders in to say, let me, slide it out. What I have seen, and I can't remember, it's a U.S.-based carrier, deferred, didn't cancel, deferred deliveries, which says that allowed somebody to come up and take your slots, and he's changed slots. So I'm seeing deferrals more than I'm out of it. I'm done.
Because there's value to stay.
Yeah, I mean, for an airline who needs the lift today, getting a plane sooner has value to them. Has some value to them. So very interesting dynamics going on. But regionals. There were a lot of regional people at that show, and at Superjet, Mitsubishi, Embraer, TRJet, Comac, XAC, Antonov, Illusion, were all there, all selling their wares, taking orders.
Doesn't that bode well for the hub and spoke?
Yeah, I think it has some positives for the hub and spoke, yes. But keep in mind, too, that there are many countries where the regionals are point-to-point, too. They're just developing. I mean, you could make an argument that in China you need some point-to-point to make city pair connections that you don't have today.
Yeah.
And that's a market that's being targeted by two or three of these guys very aggressively.
It's actually, to a certain extent, true here. I mean, I've got to go to Denver. Most of these regional jets from L.A. or Burbank to Denver.
Most of it's regional jets, but the trend, the pressure in the United States is opposite the trend in the regionals. Because in the United States, on the regional market, you are limited by scope clauses, which that's going to be one that's going to be fun to watch, because State West bought 100 Mitsubishi 90s with a scope clause limit of 70.
Maybe you want to scope clauses.
What it says is that the unions, the airline pilots unions, have said regional carriers cannot, pilots for regional carriers can't fly more than 70 packs on the airplane. So now we're going to give them a 90 packs airplane. This should be fun. I want to watch this one develop. But that's the trend in regionals, is to not go small, not to go to the 70, it's to go up. It's to increase.
And everything I've seen on load factors with regard to regionals, they're pretty high.
Very high.
Very high. Way above what we used to consider normal capacity.
Yeah, you know, the one that I said, the one that I see a lot because we're on the airplane is the SSJ 100. Superjet 100, Interjet down in Mexico, and their load factors are unbelievable. And it performs well for them. They're making money on them. So it's very attractive.
Any C-919 sold outside China?
Well, I would just say that keep in mind that out of the first 100 orders, 20 of them went to GECAS. Is that out of China? You tell me. I don't know where they're going to lease them, but the fact that a Western leasing company like GECAS was part of the first 100 that were ordered says something.
Any strong thoughts on BRICS and the real impact? Rumor has it that the UK will not into the Atlantic.
We're observing the world's biggest game of chicken.
Boy, isn't that the truth?
Yeah. Because I think what became rapidly apparent, you know, is during the Farnborough Air Show, Britain went through the leadership change. Cameron was at the first day of the air show. He announced the P-8 deal, the Apache deal, and by the third day, he was gone. Theresa May was prime minister.
Wouldn't it be nice if we had such a quiet?
I didn't say it was quiet. Immediately,
to Mars, it certainly was.
Theresa May turned around and made Boris Johnson the foreign secretary. Yeah. But it was just very quick. The thing that started to really come up during the air show, which I thought was very interesting, is the regret issue with the vote.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, one of the things that the Brexit folks were promising is we're sending 350 million pounds a week or some obscene number to EU, but if we leave the EU, we're going to give that to the National Health Service. Well, not so fast. We were just kidding. We have places like Cornwall, who farming rural agricultural, who voted to leave, who is getting 60 million pounds in subsidy a year from the EU. Hello, UK government, will you continue that? Well, probably not. So, a lot of what are the promises, what are the not promises? The other thing that's coming out is what I call intergenerational anger and angst. When you look at how the vote was split, those who were approaching their golden years, the older generation, overwhelmingly voted to leave because they wanted to keep what they perceived as their social benefits. The younger generation overwhelmingly said, stay, because of job opportunities, educational opportunities, things of this nature. And so now there's a lot of anger about with the younger generation about the older generation shafted them. They use other words, but I'm being polite to them. So you've got that kind of dynamic taking place. And then the complicated life. This is the United Kingdom. Well, what's in the United Kingdom? It's actually four countries. Great Britain, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland. Two of those voted to remain. Overwhelmingly voted to remain. So, are we going to have another Scottish referendum? Good question. So, just at a social level. The biggest single issue right now is, though, is the uncertainty around. Will they? Won't they? If they will, when? What are the conditions to get the exit? And that's where another one of those wonderful promises, because the UK depends significantly for their economy on the single market in a number of reasons, not the least of which is the financial, because they can deal in European-denominated bonds, EU bonds, euro bonds. If they leave the EU, probably won't retain that. The impact on London as a financial center is going to be horrendous. And boy, you can, I mean, literally within a week, you can see the knives out. You know, Germany, the city, several cities, Frankfurt was pushing, Paris was pushing, Brussels was pushing to become that new financial hub. A lot of uncertainty.
What about the London, you may not have any uncertainty about this as well, but Britain, with the UK, has established itself as a specialist in wings. And, you know, so that obviously impacts Airbus, make wings for Airbus. And if they leave, all of a sudden you've got tariffs and a whole bunch of other stuff. What was the rumors, at least, on? Is Airbus planning on pulling all that wing stuff out of Britain and bringing it back to the continent?
I must see. I think I wrote it down. Fabrice Berger had something to say on that. Fabrice Berger is being the CEO of Airbus. The UK is a supplier of wings. It's one of the UK's four pillars of aerospace investment. Wings, engines, aerostructures, and complex systems being the four.
This is the head of Airbus talking.
Well, yeah. The Airbus CEO, Fabrice Berger, has said the future will depend on UK's competitiveness and openness relative to other countries.
Interesting. You're in competition, in other words.
Correct. Literally, it wasn't a week before both Germany and Spain says, we can make wings. So, there's a number of aerospace implications to this, aerospace aviation implications. The airlines are seeing an impact immediately. They got an immediate impact. Part of it is the exchange rate. The pound dropped like a rock. For those of us visiting the UK, not bad. But what it does is it depresses the UK, people in the UK are great holiday travelers. They travel everywhere. They drink like fish. It's good money. Now with the value of the pound dropping, not so much. So that's really hurting both the airlines and the airports. You've got people like the IAG group. They have British Airways in the UK, but they also have Aer Lingus in Ireland, which is staying, main Ireland, not Northern, which is staying in the EU, and Iberia in Spain, which is staying in the EU. So they have some structural challenges. EasyJet, who flies those holiday passengers, is taking it in the EU. As a result, share prices have been hammered. EasyJet's down by over 30%. In share price, IAG is down by over 20%. So immediately it starts to hit. Aviation industry. The UK industries get a lot of funding to the tune of £1 billion a year for aviation aerospace technology for the EU. Where's that going to come once they leave? The UK industry is also very dependent upon people coming in from other countries and bringing knowledge, technology to the program. I have a very good friend who lives in the UK, American citizen, who has liver cancer, and she's undergoing treatment. And she sent me a picture of the people who are doing the treatment, and they're this group of about 8 people. Now, this is a vignette from medical. There's about 8 people standing in the room, and they're all holding up a sign of where they're from. And there isn't anybody who's from the UK. They're all from someplace else. That's the impact of immigration on the UK economy. It's huge. So if you stop it, because you're leaving the EU.
So now, in defense of the whole Brexit issue, I believe it's Norway, who is not part of the EU, and has open borders, open tariffs, and has very successfully traversed non-EU participation, both economically and socially.
Norway has done it, but it's you have hit on the two criteria that have to be in place as far as the EU is concerned for Britain, for the UK to continue to have access to the single market. Free movement of people and free open markets, neither of which the Brexit team wants. That's the problem.
That was the going-in proposition?
It still is. It still is.
You really believe that? Because, you
well,
know,
from
she
the Brexit
brought
people,
in...
From the Brexit people, absolutely. But keep in mind, Theresa May was not a Brexit.
I know, exactly.
She was a Remain.
Yeah, and she brought in Mark Carney, or Carney.
Carney. No, Mark Carney was already there. He was the Bank of England
already.
He was already in there. He was already in the role as the head of the Bank of England.
I thought she brought him in.
No, Mark Carney was already in place.
David Cameron brought him in.
David Cameron had brought him in.
I see.
Yeah, he came in under David Cameron's watch. UK has some issues. And, I mean, number one, here's where the fun begins. The referendum is non-binding. Was always non-binding. The vast majority of Parliament, both Commons and Lords, is against Brexit.
Yeah.
What will happen? It'll be interesting. Now the EU is pressing. We want you to file under clause Article 50. What's your Article 50 letter?
We don't care what you do. Just do it.
Do it. Start the process.
And that's the problem. Once you send them the letter, you have a 2-year clock.
Yep.
Because if you haven't figured it out in 2 years, you're out. That's it. You're done. I stick a fork in it. So a lot of issues here, and I think it's going to be, in many ways, it's interesting to watch. But for any of you who would like to take a holiday in the UK, do it now. The exchange rates are good.
So you've spoken a lot about the negatives of Brexit, which is pretty obvious. Any positives to it at all? So far?
Haven't seen any.
Interesting.
Haven't seen any. The problem we have is, I'll use an Uncle Remus analogy. It's like a tar baby, globalization. Once you start down a path of globalization, extracting yourself just, it's not going to work well. It's going to bring things to its knees. It's a 50-50 bet whether or not the UK will hit a recession, severe recession, this year as a result of it, of the Brexit vote.
Without even
filing, just as a result of the Brexit vote.
Just the uncertainty of it.
Just the uncertainty of it all. It's a 50-50 proposition. And that's part of the problem is that they've engaged in a globalization process, whether it's one market or however you want to phrase it, but they've engaged in it. Now they have buyer's remorse or whatever, or think they can do better outside of it, and it's going to bring them to their knees.
Did you get any sense as to whether there's energy behind revisiting the whole vote?
depends on who you ask the question. There was an online petition, which under the rules there, if you get 100,200, a certain number of signatures, it is required that there be a parliamentary debate on the subject. And there was a petition that was done online that more than qualified to have a parliamentary debate on having a second referendum. Hadn't gone anywhere. Mm-hmm. But is there sentiment for it? Absolutely.
So they haven't had a debate.
Hmm?
You said they have not.
They have not had a debate. They have not had a debate.
I'll go out on a limb here. I don't think they're going to have a second referendum. I think that she's just going to guide Parliament through the process, and they're going to stick with the EU. That's what I think is really going to happen. Because the economic infrastructure is so tied to the EU. And the biggest issue, I think I heard from visitors that spent the last 6 weeks just prior to the election in the UK, was they're really nervous about this invasion by Arabs.
Too late.
That's what everyone else is saying too, because they're already there. I can remember being in London in 1973, and at that particular point in time, I think they referred to them as darkies. They were really people from India, and the British people hated the darkies. Just hated them. I mean, you know, it was splashed all over the newspapers. You know, there was a riot over here, and there was this kind of criminal incident, and so on and so forth.
Did everyone hear the what the number one Google search in the UK was the day after the vote? What's Brexit mean? So, because of buyer's remorse, I think it
was an emotional thing. Yeah. It was an illogical thing.
It was very emotional. The other thing that has happened, which is very discouraging, is the intolerant language that was used in the Brexit process. Once the vote happened, it has led to significant significant incidences against people who are not UK.
Discrimination.
Born and lived. Discrimination.
Is that right?
Yes, to the point of physical violence.
Wow.
And that's part of the process too, part of the problem too, is that there is a core group who is just so absolutely intolerant of anybody who's an immigrant that they will scrawl racist slogans on things. They will taunt them publicly. They will assault them. And there's been an increasing amount of that as a result of the Brexit. To the point where, I'll give you one, that if you walk around the UK today, look for people who are wearing a safety pin. That's the political statement against racism in the UK today.
Is that right?
A political statement against
racism.
Wow.
That's a big thing that you'll see in the UK today. I was very surprised walking around.
But the Brits come by that almost on a traditional measure. I mean, you know, I can remember reading history about when they came to the United States and, you know, just literally wiped out tribes of Indians and so on and so forth. And certainly the way they treated the colonists from the standpoint, well, you know, they're just colonists. They're not really English.
Well, that may be, but I think that it was kept in check. Not perfectly, but it was kept in check. I think there are groups within the UK who saw the Brexit vote as open license.
Wow.
And interpreted it that way. and you see that. So there's a lot of pressure on the society in the UK as a result of Brexit as well.
Wow.
That usually has an economic rate of their people taking their jobs and things like that. Is that the basis for this too, or is it just more they're different than us?
I think it's part of the intemperate language that was used in the Brexit campaign related to that the immigrants were taking benefits. And I think that's what drove some of the emotional reaction of the older generation.
Sort of what's happening here with the illegal immigrants, we're paying for them kind of thing.
I cannot comment on that subject.
No, but I mean,
I think that's a large part of it. I think it's a large part of it.
So the people came in and they live off my tax money. Is that what kind of...
But see, the difference in language relates to illegal and legal. Because you have to remember that many of the people that are there that are being discriminated against today are legal immigrants.
Right.
They went through the process. Yeah. They did the paperwork. They did all this. But they're from other countries. And that's where the interesting side of it comes.
We've gotten a long way from aerospace.
No, on the contrary, I contend that this is exactly what aerospace is about. Because as we see these world economies emerging and the entire transportation industry collapsing the size of the world, this ability to get along is just paramount across national borders.
Well, it's also step back and take a look at it from one of the concerns of the UK aviation industry is if you go into the big guys, the Rolls Royces, the GKNs, the BAEs in the UK, you're going to find people from a lot of countries because talent is not exclusive to that country.
Right.
And if you shut off that talent,
you're dooming yourself.
You're hurting yourself badly in high technology industries like this.
Yeah.
You seriously hurt yourself. And when you look at the UK companies, that's an issue for them. That's an issue for them. Now, today, the guys like, you know, I'll pick on the big guys, the Rolls Royces, the BBs, the GKNs. They haven't yet been materially impacted by Brexit yet. Because they do most of their business outside, so they're benefiting from the exchange rate. So there's some upside, so to speak, or less of a downside. But when you talk to them, and they will tell you, I'm getting people from Germany and France and Spain and name other countries. That's where a lot of their young talent is coming from. And if you shut that off, what's it going to do to the industry, the aviation industry? It's going to paralyze it. It's going to hurt it. And oh yes, we're getting research funding from the EU to the tune of £1 billion a year. Is the UK government going to write a check for that? Not likely. So,
interesting times.
It's an interesting times, yeah. As the Chinese say, may you live in interesting times.
So we talked a lot about, well, we talked about the commercial side. You said that Farnborough also had a significant defense component to it as well. Any observations on that side of what's going on? I mean, clearly as far as the U.S. goes, no new platforms, but a lot of incremental system development of what goes on those platforms. You know, the cockpits and the missiles and all that stuff. What do you see in Farnborough?
I think it's significant that the first big deals announced at Farnborough this year were the U.K. signing up to take the P-8 and the Apache helicopters. Those are the first big deals announced. That kind of sets the tone. You see a lot of you know, one of the folks we had a chance to talk to, for those of you who remember this one, the Dornier 328, one of the few airframes that is both a turboprop and a jet airplane. You can go either way. That's being resurrected.
That's a Russian.
It was purchased by Sierra. The Dornier assets were purchased by Sierra Nevada Corporation. And so the TR jet is starting up in Turkey. One of the owners of Sierra Nevada is from Turkey. And they're out there promoting special mission, maritime patrol, AEWC, on these aircraft. You're starting to see a lot more of the, what else can I use the aircraft for? Can I make it a multi-mission? So it's kind of, the military is there. It's a little different, perhaps, in character than what we've envisioned. You know, we had the first flyby of the F-35 that didn't land. Just flew by. Of the F-35.
That's an improvement that they plan to design in.
Yeah.
I think that'll be in Block 42 or something.
Like that. No. There were restrictions on this thing landing at Farnborough because they had to fly it out of a UK base north of London. But we had the flyby by the F-35. Very, very exciting. Very nice. What we saw of it. But you know, it's more about not so much new programs, but extensions of existing or upgrades or service life. We've talked to a company that I need to keep anonymous for the moment about. They've been flying this plane for 10 years. They kind of figured it would phase out, but now they're going to keep it for another 15. Oh, my. Got to refurbish it. Got to upgrade it. You know,
that's where the aftermarket comes.
That's where the aftermarket comes. So, a lot of activity there in that regard.
So, curiosity question, what percentage of your business is commercial versus defense?
For us, it's probably 95.5.
Okay.
But, as I said, we're seeing a lot more activity on the military side than we've seen in a long time. I'm the opposite of what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. What do you attribute that increase in military activity to?
Hey, I thought my plane would be out of life, and now I'm going to keep it for another 5 years. I got to stretch it out, so I got to refurbish it. I have to make it suitable for them to keep using it for another 10 years or so.
I was just talking to a company last week that got $12 million worth of spare orders for C-17.
Mm-hmm.
Their view is based on a run rate that they've seen in the last 2 years on spare orders, that $12.5 million is going to turn into $25 million over the next 5 years. Just because there's so many spares going out.
I'm not quite that optimistic on the C-17. I've got hardware on it. But I do see it as there is going to be a healthy level. I'm not quite sure I'd go crazy like that, but there is going to be a healthy level for that platform. But
it was an IDIQ contract,
mm-hmm.
and on one particular part, the POs in hand already exceed the IDIQ limitation.
Yeah, I've got the C-17 too, so I know.
You know,
clearly. No, I think it's, like I said, I think the militaries are being forced into two approaches. One is take what you have and make it last. Or, in selected cases, you can have a new platform, but you can't have the traditional method of getting there. Case in point, airborne early warning. You know, we have the, you know, for us, the E3 Century or whatever, E8 for the Navy side, E6 for the Navy side. Sorry. what I see countries going to is they're taking a large cabin business jet and making an AEWC platform. So they don't have to develop a new airplane.
They've been doing that for 15 years.
Yeah, but it's much more pronounced.
Is that right?
Much more pronounced. Yeah, they've been nickel and dime. I see big programs coming. Yeah. I'm bidding on whole programs today.
Wow.
I'm going, really? That's nice. Okay. So I'm seeing much more of a, let's get a little more creative and a little more clever about how I meet my needs.
That certainly explains the trend in Gulfstream versus what I see in business jet demand.
How do you spell success? Special mission.
Good.
There you go.
What are those significant? Because maybe we didn't ask all the questions that you thought of. So what are the other significant findings that you got out of Farnborough that we haven't asked you about?
Well, there were two interesting phenomena that took place around Farnborough that I made note of. Number one is the behavior of the Russian and the Ukrainian aviation communities. Because it used to be part of the old Soviet Union, there was a lot of interplay between the two. Which meant a platform that we are on, which is the Antonov 148-158, which is used as a regional as well as emergency transport, has been co-built in Ukraine and Russia since the start. The Russian ministry has now come out and said any Ukrainian content must be removed from that airplane. And as much Western content as possible must be removed, provided it makes economic sense. So the Russians are becoming much more insular. Now, there are ways around it. I'm not going to reveal those because I can get myself in trouble. But there are ways around that. The Ukrainians are doing the exact same thing in reverse. Any Russian content must be replaced by Western content. And by the way, all the certification that was done under the Russian ministry, we want to have done by EASA or FAA.
Oh my God.
It's fun.
God bless.
The good news is there's opportunities, but yeah. We'll go. But the one that really kind of, there was a lot of talk about 3D printing on airplane parts.
Okay.
And I'm just going to pick on two as an example. Just a couple of pieces of data. Boeing is placing thermoplastic parts across their whole fleet. They have over 20,000 specific part numbers in service today that are 3D printed thermoplastic.
None of those are flight critical yet, though.
There's nothing that's flight critical with plastic.
These are plastic, sorry.
Thermoplastic.
Yeah.
In addition, Boeing is developing what are called 3D printed micro lattice material.
Wow.
Where air is 99.9% of the structure by volume. Now, there's some patent fights going on around that, which we can get into, I'm aware of. But DARPA is funding this. And the idea here is you start using it for cabin stowage bins and sidewalls.
Real weight reduction.
Real weight reduction. Airbus has taken a slightly different tune. They are developing parts from metal powders. And in doing so, are establishing standards and allowables for these materials. Last year, they did a titanium alloy, qualified it, standardized it. This year, they're working on an aerospace-grade stainless.
Wow.
And next year, they'll be doing an aluminum alloy. So they're kind of working in that. But what's even more interesting is Airbus is approaching things with a very interesting technique called bionic design. And what it is in the design algorithms, they're designed to mimic the layout of living things. For example, the structure of the network structure of a loop. The benefit for them is it allows them to create extremely high strength-to-weight ratio shapes. And they have been flying several of these since 2014. So it's not just the material, it's how the material is used. Getting away from our standard thinking process in aerospace to more of mimicking Mother Nature in her structural patterns.
What's it called?
Bionic design.
Mm-hmm.
So they're investing. They only kind of, they both kind of gave this high level, for lack of a better term. But those were a couple of the highlights of it. But it's clear that Boeing and Airbus are very aggressive about pursuing the use of 3D for weight, for cost. This one on this metal microlattice is really an interesting area.
Are they developing all of that technology in-house, or are they looking to partners to help something like that?
Yes. A large part of the work is being done in-house.
Right.
But they do have partners that they're working with in this regard. Boeing is getting funding on the microlattice from DARPA, so it's out of the defense budget. And there is another company that has the claim patent rights on microlattice, so there will be a fight going on.
FYI, there is beginning. There was an article posted recently, and I can't remember the circumstances, but it was the first time a flight critical 3D part had been flown. I think they used it for a strut or something. But
bracket.
Huh?
Bracket.
Mm. Yeah, it was okay.
But it was a
flight critical part, and they flew it. So we're starting down that road now.
Yep. That was Airbus is using Airbus is using 3D printed parts in the wing brackets. So yeah, they have been pushing the. They seem to have kind of gone. Boeing has kind of gone into the more of the thermoplastic. Although I could argue the microlattice is kind of getting into another side, but Airbus has gone very much on the metallic. They're spending an enormous sum of money on the metallic side, both in their own facilities, and then they have a couple of local. Most of the work that I've seen has been done out of Hamburg. So those were two really kind of, to me they were eye-opening. I'll leave it up to you guys to decide if that's interesting for you, but they were interesting for me.
Really great day.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.